Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Who have been America's best presidents? Who have been the worst? And what criteria can we apply to rate the performance of the dozens who fall somewhere in between? When Harvard scholar Arthur Schlesinger published his poll of historians' assessments of presidential greatness in 1948, he began a tradition that invited lively debate and analysis that continues to this day. And while Washington, Lincoln, and FDR have pretty consistently earned top assessments, we can learn a lot about ourselves and our view of the world by looking at the shifting ratings of those who follow. Robert W. Mary is editor of The National Interest and served for 22 years as an executive with Congressional Quarterly. He writes about all of this in his new book, Where They Stand, The American Presidents in the Eyes of Voters and Historians. Bob, welcome to Think.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be with you.
How do we define greatness in a president?
Well, I think greatness is as greatness does, isn't it? It's a question really of what a president accomplishes and whether the country at the time and the historians later and history generally accord that kind of greatness. But I have some criteria. I think that I have in my book six presidents that I call leaders of destiny, and I think they would be the presidents that you would consider to be the greatest of the American presidents. And all were considered consistently by the historians in these polls that you talked about, either great or near great on a consistent basis. Number two, they all were given high marks by the electorate at the time. In other words, they were two-term presidents who were succeeded by their own party, meaning that they had two separate terms that the voters liked sufficiently to retain them and their party in power. And thirdly, my test, which is that they all managed to transform the political landscape of America and set the country upon a new direction. And those presidents would be, in order of service, Washington, Jefferson, Jackson, Lincoln, Teddy Roosevelt, and Franklin Roosevelt.
When you look at a president, every one of them, even the very greatest, made some mistakes. Do their successes? Does any president's success matter more than the mistakes he might make, or are they equivalent? Or how do you assess those things?
Well, that's the fascinating thing, and both in terms of the electorate and in terms of history, the question is, where's the balance? Take one example. As you say, even the greatest made some significant mistakes. But what about somebody like a Richard Nixon, who is considered by the historians to be really down there in the failure categories, consistently in the bottom five? He accomplished a great deal, both in foreign policy and in domestic policy, in many cases much more liberal than his liberal critics ever wanted to acknowledge. And yet it all gets washed away in historical terms by Watergate. And is that an accurate or appropriate assessment? That's a good question. I don't know the answer. You would think that sometimes perhaps the historians would say, well, he did a terrible thing, and he certainly was left the office with greater humiliation than anyone else, but he also made some accomplishments, and they should be recognized. But the greats, look at Franklin Roosevelt. He tried to pack the Supreme Court. He got his head handed to him by the political system. He raised taxes after his second term, which generated the so-called Roosevelt recession in the middle of the Depression. So he made some significant mistakes, but overall he transformed American politics, and then he transformed the world. Not a bad day's work for a president.
If you had to name the top two presidents of the 20th century, you say FDR and Ronald Reagan, which is so fascinating because they came at the job with very different approaches and had very different sets of challenges.
Well, I think that's true, and I one of the things that I try to do in this book is to avoid any sort of partisan sensibilities to sort of creep in. I think it's fair to say that Franklin Roosevelt was probably the most liberal president of the 20th century. Reagan was probably the most conservative president of the 20th century. And yet, they both managed to transform the political landscape and give the country what it needed and wanted in terms of a new direction. And I think it's pertinent to note that the American people have hired and fired conservative presidents, and they've hired and fired liberal presidents, and they're not really voting from in terms of their collective judgment, based on an ideological framework. It's really based on what they feel the country needs at any given time.
How did Schlesinger's original poll shape the way we measure presidential greatness even now? Because I have to imagine he didn't realize he himself was making history to a certain extent when he set this up as the way we look at presidents.
No, this was Schlesinger Sr., the Harvard professor who had written widely about cycles of history and American politics and many other things. The father of course, the Schlesinger that we're more familiar with, Arthur Schlesinger Jr., who died a few years ago and was also a man of immense attainment in the historical field. But, you know, it's funny. There wasn't a great deal of scholarship or even rigor in this thing. He just simply picked, I think, the first poll, maybe 55 academics, mostly academics, a few journalists, some political scientists, mostly historians. And said, how would you rank the presidents? Give them a great, near great, average, below average, and failure. And then he calculated that and set in motion, as you say, a kind of a discourse that has spawned a body of literature regarding how our presidents fared and how they did. And what I kind of concluded is I followed this a lot because I'm very interested in politics and the presidency. I've been in Washington, D.C. for 38 years. I covered the White House for the Wall Street Journal in my younger days. So I followed a lot of presidents. I've covered a lot of presidential campaigns. And I said, well, what's missing in all of this is what were the voters thinking? What were the voters saying or doing or voting back when the guy was in office contemporaneously? And so what I try to do in my little analysis, which is really designed to provide a lot of American history through the prism of the White House, is to crank in the voter sensibility as we discuss the presidents and presidential performance.
And this is really fascinating. You believe, Bob, that every presidential election is ultimately a referendum on whoever currently holds office, even if that person is not running again because he's completed two terms or because he's chosen not to run. It's always about the guy who's currently in office.
I do believe that, and I think that's kind of controversial. It's controversial in part among all my pals and colleagues among political writers because I'm saying essentially that so much of what they're fixated on during a campaign, the gaffes that occur and the fundraising differentials and things of that nature are not really all that significant because the American people somehow, in an almost mystical way in my view, somehow pull together a consensus, a judgment on the performance of the incumbent or the incumbent party, as you say, if the incumbent president is not running. And if you trace this concept, which I posit, and it's not original to me exactly, but nevertheless I posit it, and if you sort of trace it, you can all of a sudden a kind of a logic emerges, and you can understand why the American people chose to retain this particular president or his party at this particular time and why they basically said, sorry, out of here.
And it's a unique way to look at this also because I think a lot of people who study history would say a certain amount of time has to pass in order to accurately assess the performance of a president. But of course, voters don't get that time. They have to decide every 4 years.
I think that that's exactly right. And I think to be fair, in historical terms, I think really largely a generation pretty much has to pass mm-hmm. because otherwise there's just too many political passions of the moment that linger for a good number of years, and it's very hard for even historians, maybe particularly academics, to step back and say, okay, wait a minute, let's sort of get our own points of view out of here. So a generation has to pass. But of course, as you say, you're absolutely right, Chris, the American people don't look at it that way. The American people look at these presidents as they were invited to by the Constitution and by the Founding Fathers, which is in four-year increments. They have hiring and firing authority over these guys, and they take it very seriously. And so they don't have any compunction or, you know, bad feelings about saying, this guy's had 4 years, and I've had 4 years to assess his performance, and I feel very comfortable making a judgment on that.
Does it make any sense to separate out the rankings? Of course, again, voters don't get to do this. But in terms of historians, would it make sense to sort of extrapolate and say, let's look at the best presidents for domestic policy, the best presidents for foreign policy, the best presidents for civil rights, that sort of thing?
Yes, I think there's some merit in that from a standpoint of historical analysis. And some of the pollsters have tried to do that. I'm kind of more partial to the ones who follow the Arthur Schlesinger Sr. model, in which he basically said, I don't care how you make your assessment, you just make your assessment based on your criteria, and it'll all come out in the wash. But in terms of trying to parse it a little bit more carefully, yes, I think there's some merit in that, and some of the polls have done that.
And, of course, some presidents' stars and reputations have really changed over time as we as Americans have come to agree that different things are important or unimportant. And Andrew Johnson is a really interesting example of this.
Andrew Johnson and Ulysses S. Grant, I think, are almost like the polar opposites or the, you know, flip side of the same coin. So they represent examples of how changing vogues of thought or academic thinking can affect the standing of a president. So let's go back to their era. Their era was the Reconstruction era. And for many decades after the Civil War, the prevailing academic view was that the so-called radical Republicans in the Senate and Congress, but particularly the Senate, by being so harsh on the South, they had retarded our ability to bring the country back together, and that the Reconstruction that they put forward when they got control of the government from the President of the United States, who was Andrew Johnson, was so harsh that it really delayed any kind of rapprochement within the nation, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And so Johnson, as a result of that in the polls, comes out kind of middling, whereas Ulysses S. Grant, who succeeded him and who went into league with the radical Republicans and fostered much of the harshness that these people felt was detrimental to bringing the country together, was down there in the failure category. But in more recent years, within the last, I'd say, 20 years, Eric Foner of Columbia and some other academics have said, wait a minute, let's look at this a little bit differently. These radical Republicans, so-called, were really the forerunners of our civil rights activists in the 1950s and 1960s. They were trying to move the country to a point where it was going to redeem its promise to African Americans in our country, to black people, in terms of their voting rights and their civil rights, and now that got delayed. So we should look at it differently, and that's what's been happening. So the result is that Grant is rising and Johnson is declining almost in equal measure.
It's also notable that the long-term consequences may not be apparent right away. And certainly it's been, you know, a century and a half since the Reconstruction. But there may be things that take a while to come to fruition.
Well, I think that's exactly right. And that's where history has the longer view, of course, than the voters. Because the voters, let's face it, they don't really take the long view. They look at the presidents and they look at their election opportunities every 4 years pretty much as Ronald Reagan invited them to do in 1980 when he was running against Jimmy Carter, when he said, ask yourself, are you better off today than you were 4 years ago? It's a very simple question. Doesn't get into the question of how would you assess Jimmy Carter's presidency 15 years from now, right? They're not going to look at it that way. But of course, a historian might.
My guest is Robert W. Mary. He is editor of The National Interest and author of the new book, Where They Stand, The American Presidents in the Eyes of Voters and Historians. If you'd like to join the conversation, offer your opinions, or ask a question, give us a call. The number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can study a variety of topics such as creative writing, human rights, and the arts. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is National Interest editor Robert W. Merry. His new book is called Where They Stand, The American Presidents in the Eyes of Voters and Historians. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. So, Bob, if from the perspective of voters, the better presidents over time, the greater presidents, have been those who have served two terms themselves and then been succeeded by a member of their own party, do you think some of that success has to do with the fact that there's at least a 12-year legacy with which to get some of the things that these presidents believed were important actually up and running?
Well, I do think that. At the same time, I think you have to recognize that they have to get a new lease on that office every 4 years, so that it's iterative. And if they don't manage to get that lease, then obviously they're not going to be able to bring about those accomplishments. So the fact is that they failed in the first instance, and that failure basically negates any good that they might have been able to do subsequent to that.
Just yesterday on the show, we were talking with David Wessel, the economics editor of the Wall Street Journal. Yeah. And he was saying that he felt like the first President Bush may, in fact, have sort of contributed to his own demise by passing this tax increase, which he felt was important. I mean, is it fair to say that one-term presidents are mostly rather poor presidents, or do they sometimes are they sometimes just victims of circumstance?
What's interesting is that there is a pretty good, strong correlation between what the voters said about the presidents, especially the greatest by the voters' judgment and the least within the voters' judgment, and what the historians say. In other words, aren't that many one-term presidents who are then shown the door by the voters who are heralded by the historians as great presidents or successful presidents? The historians, in other words, are not saying, wait a minute, the voters are wrong here. Mm-hmm. And, of course, to some significant extent, if you believe in our system, you wouldn't want to think that the voters are wrong too often, because if they are, then maybe that raises questions about whether our system is really the greatest system, or, as Winston Churchill said, the worst ever conceived except for all the others. It seems to me that that's kind of the answer, that there's a strong correlation between the voters and the historians, and one-term presidents generally don't look too good if you look at their record overall. There are reasons why the voters let them go, and you can say, well, he inherited a terrible situation. True. But so did Franklin Roosevelt. So did Ronald Reagan. So did Abraham Lincoln. And yet they managed to bring the country through those ordeals in a way that led to their being reelected.
And what can we say about what you call the split decision presidents, who managed to get reelected themselves but not to see a fellow party successor?
I think what we can say about these gentlemen, and I think anybody who's a two-term president in our history deserves credit, because it's not easy to get elected in the first place, and it's certainly not easy to get reelected. But what we find, if we look at their terms, is that they had a particularly successful first term and a less successful second term, sometimes significantly less successful, sometimes only moderately less successful. In the latter category, moderately less successful, I would say Dwight Eisenhower, who had two strong terms. But his second term was beset by some economic difficulties. He got himself into a pretty bad situation with the U-2 incident, where he basically lied to the American people and got caught out shortly thereafter. The Sputnik launch by the Soviets was a blow to the consciousness of the American people. And there wasn't much of an initiative on the Eisenhower's part with regard to domestic policy. You can't really point to very much that emerged in his second term that would allow you to say he was a president on the move. And so the American people, by a hair, by a eyelash, decided to turn to the other party in that referendum.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Thomas in Dallas. Hey, Thomas.
Yeah, I just would point to Tolstoy's letter to liberals. where he says, you know, that an earnest man can never beat a charlatan. And, you know, you consider the stupidity of the average voter. President Mike Carter was arguably one of the most conservative presidents we had. He deregulated more industries than any president, cut more government jobs than any president, all this in 4 years. You know, with Volcker, they really did tackle the economic problems that he inherited from Nixon's price fixing and the war debt. But, you know, the fact that he wanted us to be a humbler nation really offended all the pundits and the policy peddlers in Washington, and they resented that. I don't know that your criteria is very good, you know, to turn on a stupid electorate to and the promises of charlatans to decide, you know, I mean, how we have a democracy with what's going on. But, you know, I just don't know that that's the greatest criteria.
Do you want to respond to that, Bob?
Well, sure. I mean, I understand the point of view entirely. And as Mark Twain says, and I quote in my book, it's difference of opinion that makes horse races. And I do note that the difference between the difference of opinion in horse races and in the presidential rating game is that with horse races, the difference of opinion ends at the finish line. And here we have no finish line. We have endless debate and discussion, which is why I welcome Thomas's question and his observation. I happen to believe that the system works, that the American people aren't stupid, that I'm stupid sometimes, and every individual voter is stupid and may make decisions based on stupid criteria. But collectively, some kind of a judgment emerges that is tied to the safety and sanity of the polity, if you will. And therefore, I don't believe that the winners in the presidential elections are consistently charlatans and that they win out over honest men. I think that the American people generally manage to filter out a lot of the detritus and the silliness and the questionable activities and really focus on performance. And I would argue with Thomas on the question of Jimmy Carter. I think he did some very, very good things, but if you look at the state of the economy, if you look at the state of the country and the world, if you look at the hostage crisis, which he seemed almost hobbled in terms of his ability to do something about, he didn't look like a strong leader. He looked rather hapless, and the American people, whether they're looking for charlatans or honest leaders, don't really want their presidents to look hapless or be hapless.
The list of presidents who have been equally adept at domestic policy and foreign policy seems to be rather short. But do you think that our evaluations of them based on one or the other being good enough to be reelected essentially speaks to what we think is most important at the time? Sometimes we really need to focus on foreign policy. Sometimes we really want to focus on what's going on domestically.
I think that's true, but I think that the consensus that emerges within the electorate to determine the fate of presidents and presidential candidates generally is a mix mm-hmm. of both. You can take, for example, Woodrow Wilson. Woodrow Wilson campaigned for his second term by saying essentially that he, in 1916, that he kept us out of war. And he did keep us out of war. As soon as he was reelected, he maneuvered us into World War One for particular reasons having to do with his idealistic Wilsonian view of the world. In doing that and in essentially taking over the economy on the part of the federal government so dramatically, he essentially destroyed the economy. So I think the American people were not necessarily opposed to his taking us to war, and they got enthusiastic about the patriotic concepts that underlay that decision. But they weren't very happy about the economy that was really in the doldrums for 2 years until the voters had another chance at him in 1920, and they, not him, but his party, and they tossed out the Democratic Party and brought in Warren G. Harding, who was not exactly an impressive personage, with a 60% total of the vote. And so I think that's an example of how the American people want it all, really. They don't, they, they, They're not happy. They're not going to be happy with a good war decision and a good war policy, even in a time when war is important, if it's going to upend the whole economy.
So Harding is pretty much always at the bottom of the list. Calvin Coolidge is at the bottom. James Buchanan is typically at the bottom. What do they have in common?
Well, I'm not so sure that Harding deserves to be down there, actually. I think that the worst president we've ever had is James Buchanan, who I also think was the worst man, whoever. He was a charlatan, and I think that he was probably the man of the sort of the least character whoever became president. But what they had in common, I think, is that they certainly didn't move the country in a direction that seemed to represent progress. They often proved hapless and helpless in the face of serious crisis that needed presidential leadership. That's particularly the case of Buchanan and also his predecessor, Franklin Pierce, who also tended to like the alcohol maybe a little bit too much. Coolidge is really, he's been in the bottom five only once in one of the polls, and so he's a little bit above that level.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. That's where we hear from Steve in Dallas, who says, it seems we give some moral leeway to the founding fathers regarding their participation in slavery. Will history eventually erase any negatives that surrounded Nixon's presidency and Clinton's indiscretion?
Well, that's very interesting, and we do tend to do that. I think we tend to. Some people have difficulty looking at the figures of a past political era in terms of the thinking and the vogues of thought of that particular era. And slavery is a good example, because slavery is something that almost all Americans shudder at now, just the thought of it, and yet the idea that people as great as a Thomas Jefferson could consider it sufficiently normal to simply accept that kind of a practice going forward, however much they might have lamented it in their private moments. I would think that Nixon is an example of a president who basically messed up terribly and brought a huge ignominy upon himself. He may rise in the polls. But on the other hand, when you think about a president bringing that upon himself and through his own character flaws, without doubt, it may be difficult to see how that's going to happen anytime soon.
Some conservatives have argued that historians tend to be more politically liberal as a group than the general population, and that therefore their rankings have been skewed accordingly. Is that a valid complaint?
To an extent, it is.
Mm-hmm.
And I would look at it on the basis of two different sort of categories of thinking. First of all, there are very clear instances in which the historians have brought a president into the polls in a way that reflects their liberal bias. And the two best examples are Eisenhower, who was brought in 1962, Arthur Schlesinger Sr.'s second poll, just a year and a half or so after he left office. And the historians had him down in, like, next to Chester A. Arthur and the aforementioned Andrew Johnson, down in 27 or something like that. And that clearly was a reflection of the particular political points of view of the people who answered the poll survey. But what happened, interestingly, was that almost immediately in the subsequent polls, Eisenhower started to move up inexorably, and now he is consistently considered to be in the near great. He's never put in the great category, but in the near great category, he's usually somewhere between 9th and maybe 14th, and I think that's probably about right. Another example of this was Reagan, as I noted, and Reagan came in pretty much in the same category. I think he also was right next to Chester A. Arthur, and there was a poll conducted of some 750 historians, history professors around the country, and it asked a lot of questions regarding how you felt about Reagan on this or that or this policy, that policy, and it reflected a very strong liberal inclination on the part of the people who filled out the polls. But Reagan also is now rising, so I think as the passions cool, of the moment, that a certain dispassionate assessment emerges. And the other thing I would say is that I don't hold much truck with individual assessments. I mean, I have my view of the presidents, but I don't think it's particularly significant. But a whole series of polls over time generally tends to, with a collective judgment of some thousands of historians, generally tends to filter out some of that so that we get what's a pretty good assessment. And a Wall Street Journal did a poll in 2005 in which it tried very hard to account for and to adjust for any biases, right or left. And interestingly, the poll came out very similar to what the other polls had done.
Of course, we never had the opportunity to see whether John F. Kennedy could have been reelected. It didn't appear, at least at the time of his death, that it was a sure thing by any means. And yet a lot of American voters, non-historians, just regular people, sort of look back fondly at that presidency, regardless of what their politics were at the time. Is that about emotion more than rational assessment of whatever he did or did not do?
I think he generates a lot of nostalgia for good reason. He was such an attractive man and such a dashing figure. I think you've got it right when you say that it's really difficult for us to know what he would have been able to accomplish. He did have a strong agenda, and he was pushing his agenda, but he wasn't pushing it with a great deal of apparent success at the moment at which he was killed in Dallas in 1963. And so would he have brought about success in time for his reelection? It seemed to me that that's a very difficult question to answer. And so I say in my book that we really can't assess Kennedy.
My guest is Robert W. Mary. He's editor of The National Interest and author of the new book, Where They Stand, The American Presidents in the Eyes of Voters and Historians. We would love to have your opinions on this question. If you'd like to give us a call, the number is 1-800-933-5372. And of course, you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a graduate education flexible enough to allow you to explore what matters most to you. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is National Interest editor Robert W. Mary. His new book is called Where They Stand, The American Presidents in the Eyes of Voters and Historians. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or think@kera.org. Bob, you have written extensively in the past and also in this book about James K. Polk. And in fact, we could probably spend the rest of the hour talking about him. But give us a perspective on your sense of Polk's relative importance as a one-term president.
Well, he was a one-term president, and he's generally considered by history to have been our greatest one-term president. He was one-term president by choice. He's the only president, I'm pretty sure, who ran on a one-term promise. In other words, once he got the nomination of his party, the Democratic Party, in 1844, he accepted the nomination and said, if elected, I will not run for a second term, and he kept that promise. But he set for himself some very, very outsized goals. He wanted to bring Oregon Territory into the United States. It had been jointly occupied by both the United States and Great Britain up to that time for some 27 years or something like that. He wanted to bring California into the Union. That was audacious because California was part of Mexico, and Mexico had evinced absolutely no interest in selling it. So how was he going to get California unless he was going to manipulate the United States into some kind of a war with Mexico, which he, in fact, did? He wanted to reduce tariff rates. If you want to understand how sensitive tariff rates were, just think about the tax issue today and you get a sense of it. And he wanted to create something called the Independent Treasury, which was sort of the forerunner to the Federal Reserve Board. So he had big goals, and he accomplished all of those goals. In addition to which, Texas came into the Union under annexation on his watch. So he was a very consequential president.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Gregory in Colleyville. Hi, Gregory.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I was wondering, and you may have covered this a little bit, about how the policies of a president, probably more contemporary speaking, if they cause a negative effect in this country, if that affects their popularity. I'm thinking maybe Reagan, because I think y'all had somebody on recently who was saying it was some of his policies that are causing the problems we have now.
Yeah, and that gets back to the whole question of sort of the long-term and the short-term consequence of certain policies. But I have to say that I think that the American people, basically, in this referendum process that I talk about, look at the new guy who comes in as a result of the decision that's made, and essentially say, look, you can run the country from the right, you can run it from the left, you're just going to have to make this work. And then we're going to assess you 4 years hence and determine whether you, in fact, did make it work. My book goes into some considerable extent on what Reagan managed to accomplish in turning around an economy that he inherited that was really dangerously close to flipping out of control. The inflation, the stagflation, which was inflation and a declining GDP at the same time, a stagnant GDP for much of that time, it was causing all kinds of other kinds of structural problems in the economy and in American society. And it was a very, very perilous situation that he inherited. And he managed to turn it all around in 4 years. And so the American people rewarded him with a landslide victory. Now, you can argue that he didn't care sufficiently about the deficit, and I wouldn't argue with that position at all. But the fact of the matter is that the deficit was coming down rather dramatically in his later years of his presidency, largely because of economic growth that he unleashed. And had that managed to continue, as indeed it did resume under Bill Clinton, much of that debt that he saddled us with would have been eradicated, as in fact much of it was under Bill Clinton.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also email think@kera.org. Email here from John asks, if you could talk about how George W. Bush's presidency is perceived thus far by historians.
Well, first of all, as I say, that it's really not fair to try to give a historical assessment on a president prior to the passing of about a generation. But we do know how the voters responded to him. And I say in my book that George W. Bush's first term was a moderate success, sufficiently a moderate success for him to be reelected. The economy, and I think that his tax cuts helped spur the economy, was percolating fairly well at the time of his reelection time in 2004. He did get us into a war in Iraq, but it wasn't clear at that point, at the time of the election, in November of 2004, that war was going to go awry. I thought it was, and wrote a book about it, but I don't think it was clear to the American people. So that wasn't a huge negative. And so his first term was a moderate success. I think his second term is going to be marked by historians as being a really strong failure, because the war did not go very well, and it didn't. And much of sort of the underlying rationale for the war essentially fell apart. The economy fell apart, and much of what happened to the economy is directly attributable to decisions that he made. So I don't think history is going to be particularly kind to him. But as I say, we can't really say that quite yet.
Bob, how accurate would you say our judgments as voters are with regard to the relative role of the president in affecting the quality of life here in the United States as compared with, say, the importance of the legislature or of the judicial branch?
Well, they get the credit and they get the blame, irrespective of whether they deserve it or not. And I note in the book, just as we were talking about Reagan, for example, some people believe, some conservative Republicans, including people with strong economic credentials, believe that Bill Clinton's economic success is attributable in large measure or significant measure to policies that Ronald Reagan unleashed. In other words, he cut taxes and he cut the impediments to enterprise, such as regulation and other things, that unleashed sort of a wave of entrepreneurial development and technological development that then spurred the economy and brought about significant productivity for significant years into the future. That's the argument. And I'm not embracing it now or necessarily denigrating it. But the fact of the matter is that whether you want to attribute the good economy in Bill Clinton's time to these Reagan policies, and I don't think that's a frivolous argument, Bill Clinton gets the credit for it because his job is to not, to leverage whatever opportunity he has to make sure that the country is moving forward smoothly, particularly in the economic realm. And he did that, so he gets the credit for it. Conversely, some people believe that Calvin Coolidge bears a significant responsibility for the difficulties that beset his successor, Herbert Hoover. But in our political system, it was Hoover's responsibility to figure out how to handle that situation, whoever was responsible for bringing it about, and he didn't do that sufficiently to be reelected. And I think that history is not looking upon him very favorably. Maybe it could be more unfavorable than it really is. So the president gets the blame and the president gets the credit, and I think that leads to a certain amount of political accountability, and that's probably healthy.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Mark on the line in Arlington now. Hi, Mark.
Hi. I was interested in hearing the guest describe John Kennedy's agenda as strong and also talk about how he did not necessarily succeed very much in driving it through while he was alive. I was wondering if he could speak about what exactly that strong agenda consisted of and what impediments made it difficult for him to push it through while he was alive.
Well, much of what Lyndon Johnson accomplished in terms of civil rights, in terms of reducing taxes, which spurred the economy, in terms of the Voting Rights Act of 1965, all of those were part of the Kennedy agenda. But Kennedy was not showing himself to be very successful in getting that through Congress. Now, Johnson was a master of Congress and a master of the Senate, of course, and he did it. But I think that probably the death of Kennedy had an emotional impact on the American people that contributed a great deal to what Johnson was able to accomplish. But what he did accomplish was largely the Kennedy agenda, and that was an agenda that was kind of stuck at the time of his assassination.
We have an email here from Brian in Dallas who says, based on the patterns outlined in this book, could you explain the important factors in play for the 2012 election?
Well, yes. In terms of my interpretation, which, as I note, is somewhat controversial among experts on politics, my model being that these are largely referendums, I would say two things. Number one, I think Barack Obama is making a mistake when he is attacking his opponent, Mitt Romney, so vociferously. I don't think he needs to do that because the American people are, he doesn't need to cut Mitt Romney's legs off in order to have the American people make an assessment about his presidency. And in fact, his record going into this election is not all that negative. I would say that in terms of referendum politics, he's definitely competitive for re-election and I think probably favorable for re-election right now. So I think that's kind of a mistake on his part. In terms of Romney, if you sort of follow my formula and so I say, well, what does it matter what Romney says? Because if you say it's just a referendum on the incumbent's performance, how is Romney going to affect the election? Well, he's not very much, but he, if perchance, based on referendum politics, he does get elected, he's going to have to run on an agenda, and he's going to have to, if he wants to succeed, he's going to want to be able to go to Congress and say, I have a mandate here from the American people, and he's not going to have a mandate if he doesn't explain to the American people through the course of this campaign what, in fact, he plans to do if he ever gets to the White House and gets the power of the White House. And he's not doing that. So I think that's a mistake on his part.
The other thing that is tantalizing to think about based on your formula is the idea that the election of Barack Obama was very historic and that it was about him as an individual and about what he represented. If we apply your formula, it really was about the American people saying, I am done with the policies of George W. Bush.
And the policies of his party. Mm-hmm. And I think that's absolutely right. And then the opportunity was for Obama to, especially given the economic crisis, and I use that word advisedly, that we were in at that time, it was an opportunity for Obama to change the political landscape, to sort of to scramble up some of the political fault lines and to create new coalitions. My view, my political analysis is that he didn't manage to succeed in that, and I think that's one of the reasons why the election is as close as it is.
How does your formula apply when you're thinking about elections like the last one in which there was no incumbent candidate, even if there was an incumbent party, and both parties had to, through a series of primary elections, decide on the candidate they wanted?
I don't think that my formula for how presidential elections work has any relevance particularly to the nomination process.
Mm-hmm.
So the nomination process emerges within the parties, and I think that it's become kind of a mess. I kind of like the old system when those guys in smoke-filled rooms who knew these guys real well would emit their smoke and to make their decisions. But those days are long gone, and they're not coming back. So I just have to get used to it.
Do you think we're doing better at understanding the individuals that we elect? I mean, there's so much debate on an ongoing basis about, you know, the way politics is covered in the media.
Well, I'm a historian, and as a historian, I've gone back, especially in my research on James Polk and my research on the post-war era for the book I did on Joseph and Stuart Alsop. So I've looked into how the media in previous eras presented information about members of Congress and candidates for president. And I have to say that I think that in the old days there was a lot more information. Today there's a lot of hot air and there's a lot of discourse about it, but I'm not sure there's as much information in what the media is presenting to the American people as there was in the 1840s, for example, when Polk was running. Man, you learned a lot if you were reading those papers in Washington in the 1840s.
Robert W. Mary is editor of The National Interest and author of the new book, Where They Stand, The American Presidents in the Eyes of Voters and Historians. Bob, it's been a fascinating hour. Thank you so much for spending it with us.
I've enjoyed it very much, Chris.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bellotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. And Jeff Whittington is senior producer. You can learn more about Think, find out about upcoming shows, and download the free podcast every single day at kera.org/think. You can email any comments, questions, or suggestions for the show to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.